I was asked a question, how did I deal with the chewing addiction? I stopped eating between meals. I ate only when my meals were. It's as simple as that. I was asked how I dealt with the chewing addiction, and my answer is I ate only 3 meals a day, nothing in between. So I don't eat or I don't chew or suck anything between meals. Okay? I should say that I adapt this as needed. Just recently I went on a very long bike trip where I was going, 100 kilometers a day or up and down hills and stuff like that. Well, you can't eat 3 meals a day and do something, at least I can't. I found that out a couple of years ago when I did the same trip. So I knew I had to eat snacks on the way. But I was very careful to make sure that I ate abstinently and all that. So I adapt this, but generally speaking, 3 meals a day, nothing in between. I never eat in between meals. That's simple. Okay. I someone reminded me I forgot to tell the joke. I must be tired. What the heck was the joke?
We'll get back to you.
What was the joke? Who reminded me of the joke? What's the who? The house. Yes. A man is. It's the same joke. I mean, it's the same kind of joke. A man is living in Kansas on a house, and he has his rocking chair on the porch or the veranda. He's rocking his chair, and a police car comes up and says, "Joe, you better get out of here. There's going to be a flood, and it's only a couple hours away. It's going to be higher than your house. Get out." The man says, "I put my trust and will and my trust in life and my care in the care of God as I understand him. I'm not worried." And the flood comes, and now he's on the second floor of his house, and the water is up to the level of the second floor. He's looking out his bedroom window, and a boat comes by. It says, "Joe, get in. It's going to get higher. I put my trust in my higher power, and I'm not worried." And now he's on the roof of his house. He's hanging on, and a helicopter throws down a ladder and says, "Get in, it's going to get worse. I've put my trust in God, I'm not doing anything." And he drowns. And he goes to heaven, and he brushes past St. Peter. He says, "I don't want to talk to you, I want to talk to the big guy, the big man." And he sees God, he says, "Where the hell were you?" And God says, "I sent you a car, I sent you a boat, and I sent you a helicopter. What do you want from me?" So it's all, see, it's not as good a joke. It's the same joke. I don't know if
you knew it.
Probably because you knew it, yeah. I've got to, oh God, I'm running out of time. I didn't think I would. Okay, well, we'll do what we can. So the big book says at the bottom of page 63 or page 80 in Danish version, paragraph 1, "Next, we launched out in a course of vigorous action." Launch means to push away with great force from a dock. So we pushed out. The first step of which, vigorous means with a great deal of action, real action. We're actually working now. We haven't done anything yet. We just thought a lot and we said a prayer. That's all we've done. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, whenever the big book uses the word decision now, it will mean step 3. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous, a hard effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. So we have to face them and then we have to be rid of them. Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step 4. So step 4 is starting on the inventory, and we'll find out that step 9 is finishing it. So we even though the steps as they're written, step 1, 2, 3, 4, as we read them every meeting, uses the word inventory only in step 4, we find in the big book that it's the whole process. We're getting honest with ourselves in step 4. We're getting honest with another human being. But we're going to find that an inventory is a process whereby we identify, face, and be rid of the things which block us from our higher power. And we'll find that what gets rid of the defects of character is steps 8 and 9. And the big book makes that very clear. We may ask God in step 7 to remove our defects of character, but in steps 8 and 9 is when we become different people. We are able to go to another person and say, I did this to you. I hope I am no longer that person. I want to change. I hope I have changed. I want to make up for what I've done to you so I can put the other me in the past. And that's when our defects of character are gone, when we become other people, ready and willing to change ourselves and to make up for what we've done in the past. So they go on, they say, our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we start upon a personal inventory. This was step 4. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory, a business inventory, is a fact-finding. To find a fact is to search. And a fact-facing, face facts, is to be fearless. A fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. And an ordinary business inventory looks at all kinds of things. It looks at what's selling, what's not selling. It looks at what you have in stock. It looks at how whether the things you have allow you to continue the business. Not even what you're selling, but maybe the business, the paperwork that you've got. But they say one object of a commercial inventory is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods and to get rid of them promptly without regret. So we're going to pursue that one part of the inventory in the business inventory, to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods and to get rid of them promptly without regret. We'll find out that disclosing them is step 4 and 5, and to get rid of them promptly without regret is steps 8 and 9. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. There's no second anywhere, but we'll find out that the second is basically steps 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I want to give you the overview and to talk about the forms that I hope you've all picked up. I can tell you that these forms have saved the lives of thousands and thousands of people. They are taken almost directly from the Big Book. The Big Book's approach to the inventory is quite brilliant. They are not what the early sponsors in AA did. They were created through the Big Book when Bill Wilson wrote it. The forms are not my forms. People sometimes refer them as Laurie's forms. They are not my forms. They were developed by Blaine, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Winnipeg, Canada. And I don't take credit for them. They are brilliant, and he's a wonderful man, and if anyone should have the credit, it would be him. But he would say, they're not my forms, they're straight from the Big Book. So, you know, I just want to recommend them. You can get more copies of them by going to oabigbook.info, www.oabigbook.info, where you can get them. You can also, at that place, get a book I've written. You can get it in German, Hebrew, and English, if that helps any of you. I can't read the other two languages, but I'm told that they're accurate. The Big Book's approach, it's fascinating, because how you do step 4, well, there are so many ways of doing step 4. There are so many guides to it. I'm familiar with maybe 50 to 100 ways of doing them, and I have a collection of different approaches. And I know people who have done them in other ways and who got a lot out of their step 4s. So I'm not suggesting that this is the only way to do step 4. It has one major advantage, and that is two advantages. One is that it doesn't require you to do a lot of thinking. It really focuses you, and I was just discussing this, it focuses your attention on simple questions that once you answer them will disclose a universe of truth. And the other is that it can be done quickly. For me, I guess there's a third advantage, and that is you don't feel bad about yourself when you fill them out. You begin to learn what life can be like living in a different way, with a different way of life. And I've seen methods of doing step 4 which have major disadvantages. One of them is that they take so long that you relapse before you do them. You know, here's the only joke I've ever created. All the other jokes I've got from someone else. Here's my OA joke. It may or may not mean anything in your OA experience. Do you know the jokes that all begin, how many something does it take to screw in a light bulb? Are those familiar jokes to you? No?
Yes.
Yes? There's how many stupid people does it take to screw in a light bulb? Five, four to hold the ladder, one to put hold the bulb, and four to put the ladder around. You know, that's a joke. It's not that funny, but it's a joke. Pardon me?
It's also in Denmark.
It's the same in Denmark. Okay.
Coming from Aarhus, second largest city in Denmark. It used to be that in...
Oh, so people call them the yeah. So I don't know if you have chiropractors here. One joke I was told by a chiropractor is, how many chiropractors does it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer is, only one, but the light bulb has to keep coming back for adjustments. That rings a bell with some of you. Anyway, my favorite one was written by feminists. Is how many feminists does it take to screw in a light bulb? The answer is, that's not funny. But at any rate... here's my version of it. How many OAers does it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer is, I've already answered 170 questions, and I'm not going to answer any more. You know what I'm talking about. There are some methods of doing step four that go on and on and on. And you write them and you feel bad about them. And so you feel bad about yourself. And then your sponsor says, well, if you feel bad about yourself, why don't, for every bad thing you write about, write something good? So you double the amount of time it takes you to write it. You know, and there's one that has been used in OA and AA for years. It's 25 pages long. It has 10 pages on sex, written by someone who has a very prudish approach to sex. It's 10 pages. And you know, our OA 12 and 12 asks a lot of questions like, have you ever felt jealousy? Discuss. Well, that's good for 2 weeks for me. You know, have you ever felt lust? You know, I sort of like, I don't know how to answer questions like that. So, and some people say, write the story of your life from birth to the present time. You know, all these ways of doing it, there's nothing wrong with them so long as they don't make you relapse before you finish it. And I've seen many who have tried different methods of doing it who relapse all the time. Every time they're given it, they, oh God, I have to answer these questions again. They can't stand them. They feel bad about themselves. The Big Book's approach is absolutely brilliant. Every time I look at it, I'm so impressed by it. I want to give you the overview, and then I'll go into a little bit of detail and show you the forms and talk about how to fill them out. The first form deals with resentments, and I'll talk about what that means and all that, but resentments will ultimately, as we fill this form out, will disclose four character defects. Only four. Not 27, not 300, but only four character defects. But these four character defects will go to the very heart of your soul. So once you acknowledge those and see them, you will realize how these character defects are killing you, and you will not pause at step 6 and 7 to think, well, am I really, really, really ready to have God remove these defects of character? You will beg God to remove them because they're killing you. Because you only have four of them. You can identify them, see them in all your life. So that's one thing. Secondly, these four character defects are then looked at in another light through the next two forms. In the fear form and the sex conduct form, you revisit those character defects and ask yourself and get answers to the question of what would life be like without those character defects? How can I live a life without them? So that you move from identifying them to what would life be without them? So you actually end up realizing you can live without those character defects. You won't be what they call the hole in the donut. You won't lose anything. You'll be a better person and your life will be better. So they start with what bothers you and ends up with a different life. They're absolutely amazing. I want to go into them in some detail. I'm going to give you the instructions and not refer to the book because I really don't have time. But I'm more than willing to discuss with anyone who knows these passages in the Big Book as to whether or not I've been accurate. But I think I'm pretty accurate. The first thing we do, and the first thing you remember, is that the Big Book suggests that anytime we write something on paper, we write one column at a time. So we go down rather than across. And the reason we do this is to concentrate on each question we're asked individually. And we will also see patterns within each one of these columns. So the first column in the resentment form is what you're resentful at. Now, what is a resentment? I don't know how it's translated in any of your languages. I know that even within the big book, it has a couple of different meanings. The only advice and experience I can give you is that the best way to describe a resentment is something that is living rent-free in your mind, something that you wish were not true, a fact, a person, an incident, something that bothers you, whether it's something you did to someone else or whether it's someone other people did to you or to others, whether it's just a fact of what's going on in the world, something that is occupying space in your mind, what if, or the if onlys. You know, if only I had taken that job, if only I had married so-and-so, or what if this happened or that happened. The things that keep you from living in the present, because you're always living in the past. One wonderful joke is that a normal person says, "Oh, you stepped on my toe." An OAer says, "You stepped on my toe 10 years ago." you know, and it's sort of, we keep these things and they get bottled up. So anything that bothers you. And the big book says we write down in the column number one, people, institutions, or principles. So a people is people. And I've written down there a people as horrible and awful as Hitler, and people as silly as a car that might have cut me off as I was riding my bicycle. You know, or people who are on radio and talk stupid things. You know, I mean, the difference between the horrors that, you know, and I've written down other people who have done horrible things as well. The difference between, you know, people who have done evil and people who talk stupidly is, but I put anything down that has annoyed me in my life. And sadly, you know, it's not just the big things that annoy me. It's often the very small things that annoy me more than the big things. People who play their radios too loud, or people who have earphones that you can hear the click, 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 or the boom, 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 and not the music, you know. They bother me. And all kinds of things bother me in this world. Now, I put them down. So sometimes I put down people who do this, or sometimes I've written down the names of people. I've written down the names of people who have insulted me or my father. People I couldn't be in the same room with. Actually, there was a man who once insulted... I don't know if you've ever seen the film Princess Bride. It would mean... Well, to you, the one person who's seen it, the person I wanted to say, "My name is Laurie Cherniak. You have insulted my father. Prepare to die." But that doesn't mean anything to anyone who hasn't seen the movie, so it's meaningless. But who saw the movie? It means something to you, doesn't it? It's that, you know what I mean, right? It's a great movie. Go to see it. It's a wonderful movie, Princess Bride. Kevin Kline and Manny Patinkin, and it's wonderful. Not Kevin. Yes, he's in it. Manny Patinkin's in it. Pardon me?
Robin Wright.
Yeah, yes. Robin Wright. Oh, yes, yes. Kevin Kline's not in it. Manny Patinkin's in it. Anyway. Where was I? Okay, so we write down, and then what are institutions? Institutions are gatherings of people, associations of people. I wrote down the justice system. I wrote down certain universities that bothered me. I wrote down certain institutions that bothered me. I wrote down, do you know the term talk show? A talk show host is a person that people phone into or phones out. And I wrote down talk show hosts as an institution, but I also wrote down particular ones who really, really bothered me. Anything that annoyed me. And then principles. What is a principle? A principle is any fact that you wish were not true. So I would write down things about myself. I wish I wasn't fat. I wrote down, I'll never be happy. I wrote down, I'm lonely. I have written those things down. I've written down, there will always be horrors in this world, or there will always be evil in this world, or there will always be poverty, or there is torture in this world, things that bother me. I've written down other things that are political, which I won't bore you with, because, you know, they might be more controversial. But I've written down about politicians and things like that. anything that has bothered me. I've written down ex-girlfriends. I wrote down my wife. I wrote down my father, my mother, my children. Anytime they bothered me, which in the early days was a lot. And so you just write them down. And it's amazing when you write them down. This can't take very long because it's what's on your mind now, not what should be on your mind. For instance, I remember sponsoring a woman who said to me, said, you know, 20 years ago I was raped. I went into 10 years of therapy. It's over now. I don't care about it. I don't think about it. It doesn't bother me anymore. Do I put this down? I said, why should you? It's not on your mind. It's what's on your mind right now. The Latin source for resentment is resentire, to feel again. And that's all it is. It's just anything you feel over and over again, anything that bothers you, anything that's on your mind now. So when you write it down, and my suggestion is you take an evening and you just write it down. You just write them down in the first column. On this form, you've been given little boxes. Within big boxes, just little boxes, just write them down. Anything about yourself. Don't write yourself down, but write the things about yourself that bother you. If you know the second column, you're going to be writing out sort of why they're on the list. If you know that you're going to be writing a lot on the list, then leave the second and third box free so you have more space in the second column to write. So I knew, for instance, the first time I put my mother down, I knew I had a lot to write. So I just wrote her up on the first box. I left the second and third blank because I knew that the second column would have a lot to write on. So that's the first column. If you write it in the evening, go to sleep. First of all, you'll sleep better. I think I can almost guarantee you that. Because it's amazing what you'll do. Once putting it on paper, you realize you've been juggling a lot of balls. You know, there's a lot of things going on in your mind. If you don't think of one thing, you'll think of another, and you think of another. You put them down on paper, and you're not thinking about them as much. It's really an amazing experience just to do that. And then in the morning, you'll remember some more, because once you put these down, the onion layer, you know, will be taken off, and there'll be more. But just write down whatever you can think of now. Anything that bothers you. Okay? That's column one. An hour. An hour and a half, maybe. That's it. The second column, you write in point form, little bullets, why these are on your list. This particular thing is on your list. Just little bullets. The big book uses 19, the largest set of bullets is 19 words. And, depending on your language, you may find, I mean, French uses more words than English does, so you may need 25 words to say the same thing that you might say in English in 19. I heard a big book person say, I give my sponsees the luxury of 20 words. But each point. So let me give you examples. I'll never get thin is one that I'm sure I put down one point in my life. Why is that on the list? So it's really interesting. I might write down something like, I want to be attractive. My history is terrible. My history of dieting is terrible. I'll never believe in God. You know, because those are the things that I might be thinking of just before I start the program and I'm on step four. Hitler. I mean, you can imagine all the back history of the statements I'm going to make, but what I would have written down is something like responsible for the death of millions of people. Imagine that there's a whole story there. There's a whole history. Second might be got away with it, was able to convince people that it was the right thing to do. And the third might be it can happen again. And I'm not speaking about Jews here. I'm speaking about all kinds of people who were killed. So that summarizes a lot of stuff. With an ex-girlfriend I had a difficult relationship with, there was a 24-hour period that someday, I'm not a writer, but if I ever became a fiction writer, I could write a short story about, maybe even a long short story about this 24-hour period in which if I had done this or that or this might have happened or that might have, you know, all this long history that I thought about well into my marriage. Amazingly enough, well into my marriage, well into my falling in love with my wife and loving her and never even wanting to think about that other ex-girlfriend, but I still thought about that day. So, you know what I wrote down beside her name? That day. I didn't have to write the story. I didn't have to write a long novel. I just wrote down that day. I knew what it meant, and that's all that was important. What you'll find is that when you do step five, is that part is never isn't. I would not read that part out. I never ask people to read that part. That's for you. That's your own private information. It's actually the most interesting part, but it's your own private information. So, you know, an imaginary wife. This is not my wife, who is a saint. But an imaginary wife. Really, my relationship with my wife is no one else's business, right? But I might write, you know, an imaginary person might write down for imaginary wife, not interested in sex, spends too much money, nags me all the time. I mean, there's each one of those is a long, long story, but that's what it, you know. So you put down, you know, and might even have something as silly as wants me to remember to put the toilet seat down. you know, and you can see that the difference between some of the big ones and some of the small ones can be very silly, but you write down all of them that make sense to you. It's what makes sense to you, not what makes sense to me. So anything that bothers you. There will always be torture in the world. One is, people are hurting. Two is, I am helpless to do anything about it. Three is, it's going to continue. Four is, how can I live in a world in which people allow torture to happen? I might have written those things down. So, you know, it can be very serious. I found interesting things when I would write down, I wrote down my daughter is going to fail in school. This is when, you know, she was 13 or 14. Is nice to other people, but not to me and my wife, you know. Is really a wonderful person, but doesn't think she is. You know, and so I would discover things as I wrote them down. They would become more clear to me. The person who cut me off as I was riding my bicycle and turned the corner and almost hit me, you know, almost hurt someone. And then I wrote down, almost hurt me. You know, which is a different thing from almost hurt someone, you know. I didn't take his number. I didn't look at the license plate. I should have followed him. I could have banged on his car, but I was too afraid to do it. All these different things that are just things that occur to you. There's no magic to this. You just write down whatever's on your mind. But don't make a big thing of it. Don't write long and complicated. Just bullet forms, just little points in front of each one. A friend of mine in OA had a really hurtful and hateful mother, really, really sick woman. And my recollection of what she talked about, and I my recollection isn't terrific, it's been for quite some time, but she shared on this, and what she might have written down was about her mother, hated me all her life. Well, you can imagine the stories that she might have. Made fun of my being fat. You can imagine the number of times that happened, and the number of hurts that sort of is a summary of. But that's all she had to write down, because that's what it was. Does that make sense? That's column two. And what you'll find there is probably that, first of all, you'll find that some people or some things don't need to be on the list anymore, that you've actually worked them through and you say, oh, my goodness, that's why these things are on the list. That's silly. I mean, still keep on with them, but you will get over some of it. And the other thing you'll discover is that you'll be even calmer, because this is venting. I don't know if the term means anything to you in English, but it's sort of getting rid of it's opening the steam pressure. You know, it's letting the steam out. And you're writing it down, and it's taking away from your mind and putting onto paper, and you will end up feeling a lot better. That can take 3 or 4 hours. I don't think it should take a lot longer. You might want to keep it for a couple of days to make sure you've filled it all out and you've made every point. But again, there's no magic, and it's not important if you've been complete. It's what's on your mind right now. So that's real. That's simple. I think it's simple. I'll be happy to answer any questions if people don't accept that it's simple, but it's simple to me. And then you have column three there, and it's broken up into six smaller columns. My recommendation, Big Book doesn't say this, but my experience and recommendation is that you treat each subcolumn, each smaller column individually, and go down the column on each page of resentments. So remember, you might have 50 pages of resentments, 40, 30, 20. Whatever it is, you've written them all down. You've gone down column one on each page, on each page, on each page, on each page. Then you filled out column two, each page, each page, each page, each page. Now it's time to do column three. And I suggest you do each small column. These are little, well, in the United States and Canada, they're called check marks. In England, they're called ticks. I don't know what they're called here. What would you call them? Little. Yeah, just little. Yeah. So self-esteem. The question is, does each point in column two affect my self-esteem? So let's say I had Hitler. I hate to use him as an example all the time, but it comes to mind. Response for the death of millions of people. Did that affect my self-esteem? No. Didn't affect my self-esteem. Got away with it. Did that affect my self-esteem? No. Probably not. It could happen again. Well, it might affect my self-esteem if I think I'm not doing enough to try to stop it from happening again. You know, if I think that I'm failing in my rights, if I didn't sort of say anything to someone who talked racist or something like that. So it just depends on how I see how it affects me. The driver who cut me off while I was riding my bicycle, could have killed someone. Doesn't affect my self-esteem. Could have killed me? Yeah. That affects my self-esteem. The imaginary wife, not enough sex, affects self-esteem. Spends too much money, might not affect the self-esteem. Nags at me, affects my self-esteem. Keeps wanting me to push the toilet seat, to put the toilet seat down, might not affect my self-esteem. So it just depends on the circumstances. Self-esteem is how I feel about myself. Does this particular point affect how I feel about myself? That's self-esteem. Okay? I'll never get thin. What were my reasons? I can't remember what they were, but I'll make them up. I've failed so much in the past. My self-esteem is clearly affected by that. I want to be attractive to other people. My self-esteem is clearly affected by that. Okay? Any problems with that? Okay? The next, and we fill that column out all the way down. On every page where there is, and now you don't do it by the, you do it by each of the bulleted points, each of the points that you put down in the second column. The second sub-column of column three is, affects my security or pocketbooks. Pocketbooks is an older way of talking about money. Okay, that's what pocketbooks means. Pocketbook is where you keep your money. Used to be. Now it's called a wallet or it's called a change purse, but in those days it's pocketbooks. And security is safety. Does it affect your sense of safety or your sense of security or your sense of financial safety or security? So, for instance, for Hitler, response for the deaths of millions of people does not affect my sense of security. Got away with it? Might affect my sense of security, but certainly it could happen again, affects my sense of security completely, because I don't want to live in an unsafe world. The driver who could have killed me affects my security. The wife, not enough sex, does that affect my security, the imaginary security? I don't think so. Nags at me all the time affects my security. I don't think so. But if I thought my wife was going to leave me, then it might affect, these things might affect my security. So it all depends on the situation. And, you know, what you might fill out might be very different from me, or what I might fill out today might be very different from what I would fill out 3 days from now. There's no magic to this, and it's not important. There's no right or wrong. And there were overlapping ideas. So just put in the checks or the tick marks or whatever you call them. I can't pronounce the word. Whatever fits. The next subcolumn is ambitions. Now, ambitions will, generally speaking, always be there, because an ambition is something you want out of life. And clearly, these people are on the list because what they did is something you don't want them to have done. So your ambitions are in some way challenged or thwarted or blocked. But you would look down and see whether your ambitions. Personal relationships is the next. Sex relations is the next. And is any fear involved is the next. And for each one of them, you go down and you put in little ticks or checks to see whether this particular bullet in column two affects that part of your personality. What you discover as you do this, and how long can that take, really? You know, however many forms you have, you're just bang, 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 no, 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 bang, no, no, bang, bang. You know, it's just, you're just deciding quickly whether these things are affected or not. There's no magic to this, and I don't want you to think that it requires a great deal of effort to do. It's really quite easy. You're writing things down, you're venting about them, and you're figuring out how they affect you.
But, yes? I know we're not supposed to ask questions, but in column 3, where in the big book does it say this thing about fear?
You'll see that on page 65 of the English edition, page 81 of the Danish edition, where fear is in parentheses. Okay? And you might say, why is pride there, not there? I'll say, because it only occurs once. That's the only answer I can give you. You see it?
No. But
it's
self-esteem,
in
fear.
In the example,
yes.
Yeah, in the example.
Yes. Yes. That's right. I'm sorry. It's in the example. It's not in the list above that example. Yes.
It's also when you go to fear.
Oh, no. It's in there with fears. But fear is important to put in there. And I'll talk about that. Okay. So the big book says this. Bottom of page 65 or page 81, paragraph 3 of the Danish version. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. So obviously we would have written down something that we did. We harmed someone and then we felt bad about it. I put down people I've harmed as well as people who've harmed me or others. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain, obvious, that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Any life, whether it's lived by me or an OAer, or whether it's lived by any normal person. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander, do we waste the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope, whose only hope, is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. If we were to live, we have to be free of anger. I think the freedom of anger means we might feel it, but we have to be free of it. The grouch and the brainstorm, and the grouch is the long-term rage, and the brainstorm is the immediate anger. Bill translates that in another book. Were not for us. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. I love this. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. I have a friend who hates her ex-brother-in-law who treated my friend's sister very, very badly. She hates him. I know what he did, and by all rights, I should hate him too. But I know that she doesn't eat over that. She thinks of him every so often, wishes him evil, and then doesn't think about him anymore. Whereas if I kept on, I would have wanted to kill him and not been able to do anything. And I would have killed myself because I would have gone on eating. I had to get rid of my anger at him. I had to get rid of my resentment against him. I was close to her sister. And I felt that what he had done was terrible as well. I had to get rid of that because it was fatal for me. It was not fatal for my friend. My friend had the dubious luxury of the grouch and the brainstorm because she doesn't think about it very often. It's that simple. So now the big book says this. It says we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. And here's what you will see when you fill out all these check marks or ticks or whatever. You will see hundreds of them. You know, you're guaranteed to see hundreds of them. And once you see them, you will realize that every part of your life, self-esteem, how you feel about yourself, sense of security, how safe you feel in this world, ambitions, everything you want out of this life, personal relations and sex relations and are all affected by what these people have done. And you'll also find out that you're full of fear in relation to them, that they have created fears in you. No wonder you can't think straight. No wonder you can't remember, oh, I can't eat this. That's the least of your worries. You have many other worries that go far beyond whether you eat or not. And you will realize that they are, in fact, fatal and that they are dominating you. You know, you're taking poison and hoping the other person is going to die. And these check marks are so descriptive of that. They're so, descriptive is the wrong word, but they're so glaringly obvious when you look at them how the world is killing you. And you have to change because the world's not going to change. And what they did to you isn't going to change. It's already happened. So how do you get rid of them? The big book says, how could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. Especially with the people who have harmed you or others. These are the things that you can't change, and they're killing you. They're killing you even though you'd like to kill them. Well, the big book provides two ways of dealing with people who have wronged you or anyone else. The first one is found at the bottom of page 66 or on page 66, paragraph 4 of the Danish version. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us, that's those in column 1 who have wronged us or others, were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms, that would be column 2. All the causes, all the things we put in column 2, and the way these disturbed us, that would be in column 3, all the effects that they had on us. They, like ourselves, were sick too. We acknowledge we're sick. Why can't we see that they're sick? We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. It used to say in the original draft, a friend who has cancer. I use as the example, there are all kinds of people who say hurtful things whom we don't, who, that don't bother us. Ranging from the child who might say, I hate you, mommy, or I hate you, daddy. I mean, it hurts a bit, but we know they don't hate us. They, you know, we know it's just part of the give and take of parenting at times. To the person who might be in complete pain and is grouchy and will say things that he doesn't mean. To the person who might have Tourette's syndrome or some tumor on the brain that causes the brain, the mouth to say things that the brain doesn't mean or that the person doesn't mean. There are all kinds of people who do or say things in this world whom we understand. When my wife and I were going to classes for childbirth, we were told about this moment of, it's called transition in English, where, you know, just before giving birth, the where I say your wife may start screaming and yelling at you for your responsibility in this event and telling you how much she hates you. Don't worry, it's pain, it's hormones, they love you. Well, it didn't happen, but you know, if she had done that, I guess I would have understood. It would hurt me, but it wouldn't have killed our relationship. So there are all kinds of people who do things that we understand. Why can't we look at everyone who has harmed us or anyone else as being sick people? Spiritually sick. I'm spiritually sick. I know that. That's why I eat all the time. That's why I've been full of resentments. That's why I want to be in charge of the world. Why can't I look at those people as being spiritually sick? So there's the prayer to be said. So-and-so is a sick person. God, please help me show that person the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Notice that the word forgiveness is not there. The big book does not use the word forgiveness. The big book uses the word tolerance, pity, and patience. And it's fascinating. In many religions and many people feel that you must forgive those who hurt you. And that's a wonderful thing if you can do that. But you don't have to from the big book perspective. You have to give them tolerance, pity, and patience. Now, if that doesn't work, the big book has another way of dealing with it, which will work. And that is found on page 552 of the English version and page 83, paragraph 2 of the Danish version. Page 483, paragraph 2. 483, paragraph 2 of the Danish version. It is the story of a woman who had been sober for 20 years, but knew that she had to get over her resentment of her mother, or else she would drink again. And she was given, and it's a nice story, she was given a magazine which had on the cover How to Get Rid of Resentments, written by a minister. I'm a little skeptical of the story because AA historians, and there are many of them, and they're very trivia-oriented, have never been able to discover what the magazine was. And it's hard for me to imagine that someone can have discovered. But anyway, she writes about the minister, but the advice that the minister gives is great. The minister says, if you won't find that in the small version, of course, because this is a story. The minister says this: if you have a resentment that you cannot let go of, pray for that person to have everything you want out of life. Pray for that person whether you want to or not, and do it for 2 weeks in a row, and by the end of that time, you will have got over your resentment. Now, yes, 483 of the Danish version. In the English version, it's 552 in the third and the fourth edition. In the second edition, it's page 561. The story is called Freedom from Bondage. There's an interesting story behind the woman who wrote it, but that's for real trivial pursuits. The fascinating thing about that is you first of all have to figure out what you want for yourself before you can pray for them to have it, right? And by this time, what do I want for myself? What I've discovered I want for myself is serenity and peace. I want to feel useful in life. And I want to be able to love and to be loved. What else is there when I think, well, for me, there's nothing else. That's what I want out of life. So when I prayed for Hitler to have what I want out of life, or when there was a lawyer who was a deceitful man and who fooled me and betrayed a trust I placed in him and really harmed my sense of trust in people and my sense of trust and harmed my clients. And I prayed for him to have everything I wanted out of life. All kinds of people I prayed for. And I realized none of these people had what I want out of life. You think Hitler ever felt serene? You think Hitler knew what it was to love and to be loved? Whether he was able to love and to be loved? Or that he was ever useful in his life? He had the reverse of all of those things. I began to realize that so many of the people who created resentments in me were people who not only had nothing of what I wanted out of life, but died having nothing of what I wanted out of life. That I at least had the chance of having that, and they had no chance. As a matter of fact, I realized that the more people hurt me or others, the more they hurt themselves. The more you hurt other people, the less you have a chance of getting what would be best out of life, of being the best kind of human being you can be. And I got pity. I didn't excuse them for what they did. I had no right to excuse them for what they did to others. I'm not that person. But I felt pity because they died less than animals. You know, the people who participate in genocide, the people who participate in torture, they are making themselves less human every time they do something. Less and less human. Not even animals, because animals don't torture. Well, some do, but no, I think they think they're playing or something. But they don't deliberately create pain and stuff like that. So every time human beings do things that are evil, at least in my eyes evil, pardon me if you think that torture is a good thing, but I'm sorry for taking that stand. The more people do evil, the more they harm themselves. And so, the more pity I feel. That's all I can say. And I can tell you this, I never suffered sexual assaults or physical assaults of the kind that some of my friends in OA have suffered. But they've allowed me to say on their behalf that page 552 or the page 483 in the Danish edition have allowed them to overcome their hatred of the people who have done this evil to them. They've been able to overcome it because they now realize that those people put the nail in their in their own coffin. And that they are no longer going to be governed by the harm that was done. And that the tolerance, pity, and patience that they get out of that is very, very powerful. And I'm sure there are people in this room who have done that and who have had that experience. And I've never met anyone who's not had that experience. That working this way, you get rid of your anger and your sense of frustration, and you begin to realize that even though you may have suffered harm and other people have suffered harms, the people who did the deeds have suffered their own harms and made themselves less and less able to be real human beings the best they can be. I don't know if you've ever read the book When Bad Things Happen to Good People, but it's a famous book in the United States and Canada. It was written by a rabbi, and he says something that I found to be very instructive. Not in that book, but in an essay he wrote. He said, in Jewish law, you cannot forgive anyone for harm they've done to other people. You can only forgive someone for something they've done to you. Therefore, he says, the murderer can never be forgiven, even by God. But he says, the only hope that any murderer has, or any person who's done evil things has, is that before his death, or his or her death, that person has become a different person from the person who did the deed. If that happens, then they have a chance of change. If they've changed, they're no longer that person, then that's the hope they have, the only hope they have. And we are given that hope in this program. We are given the opportunity of changing from people who have done harm, maybe not harm in the same way that harm was done to us, but have done harm, and we've been given the chance of changing into people who can do good. And the most we can feel for people who don't have that opportunity is pity. So once we do that, and we've ended up getting rid of this feeling of resentment and anger at these people, we are now in a position to put out of our minds the wrongs that others have done and look to our own mistakes. And the form itself has two dotted lines on it, which allow you to fold the paper over, and I'm just showing you, so that you put out of your minds column 2 and column 3, and you have column 4 right across from the names. And the question to be asked is, where in relation to this person, this institution, or this principle, have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Okay? It's late in the day. Just bear with me. This is among the most important things that you'll ever do in your OA life. I'm sorry to do them so late in the day. I wish I had done them a little earlier, but I didn't. What does selfish mean? We learned back when we discussed what step 3 is all about, that selfish means wanting things my way, period. Wanting things my way rather than God's way. In relation to Hitler, where was I selfish? Not according to the dictionary definition, but I wanted Hitler not to have existed. That's my selfishness. Doesn't sound selfish, but it's selfish from the big book perspective, because I want to be in charge of life. And I want there not to be a Hitler, not to have been a Hitler. So that's my selfishness. Not much more. I don't want him to have succeeded. I don't want him to. I don't want him to have got away with it. But when I write down selfish in other respects, next to my daughter when she was 12 or 13, I might have written down, I want her to do well in school, and then I want her to do well in school so I don't have to take care of her when she's 40 years old. You know, I mean, I might have written that down. You know, the imaginary husband with the imaginary wife might have written down, I want her to have more sex with me. You know? I want her to stop nagging me. I want her to do these things that she's, or not to do the things that she's doing. So the selfishness might be less virtuous or more virtuous, it doesn't matter. But selfishness is at the very least wanting things to be different from what they are. And then we get to dishonest. And of course, the big book's examples of dishonesty are all the lies and the cheating and the stealing that the stereotypical alcoholic will have done. And of course, if you've lied or cheated or stolen, that goes there. That would be a resentment. You would remember that person you've harmed, and you would write that down. Yeah, I stole from this person. That would be one of your dishonesties, or I lied to this person. But there are two other kinds of dishonesties that are really important for nice people like us. And of course, many OAers are just nice. You know, we're people pleasers and we're nice. We don't like to rock the boat. You know, instead of going out into the world and trying to change things, we're often people who've tried a little bit to change things, have failed, and then isolate ourselves and go off into our corner and eat. So we're nice people. We don't like to be touched. We're very vulnerable. Dishonesty among many of us can be lying to ourselves about reality. I lied to myself about Hitler. When I wrote down, you know, selfish, I want Hitler not to have existed, my dishonesty was he died before I was even born. I mean, that I'm lying to myself. I mean, it's just such a stupid thing to not to have someone who's already dead not exist. You know, it's just silly. It's lying to myself about reality. It's living in a fairy world, in an imaginary world, which I've done a lot of in my life. And there's another dishonesty that is really important for all of us, for many of us, and that is not telling the truth when the truth should be told. Many of us will not speak up and tell the truth. And some of my friends who have been abused as wives, for instance, by their husbands, they would put that down. I mean, you know, I stayed in that relationship for 7 years instead of saying after the first hit, this must stop. You know, they don't blame themselves. Who can blame anyone for what they've already done? I mean, why they stay and why they don't stay or you know, that's too much of the human heart to talk about. But they know that ultimately, in retrospect and in perspective, they should have said right off the bat, this is wrong what you are doing. And you either get help or I leave. And, you know, some of my friends have decided that they harmed. Remember, if allowing a person to harm you creates harm in them, as I talked about just a few minutes ago, then allowing someone to continue harming you is harming them. Where was I dishonest in terms of Hitler? I allowed him to continue to harm me. You know, really, in the end, that's what I did. He continued to do what he harmed me. And he shouldn't have harmed me. I shouldn't have allowed that to happen. I've had people who have realized that they should have gone to the police about the rape that they experienced. And they don't blame themselves. They know how frightened they were. It's not a question of blame, but dishonesty is written down there. But even simpler, I've written down, I haven't said no when I should have said no. People have used me to do things, have got me to do things, and I should have said, no, I'm not doing them, you should be doing them. And so many of us are like that. We're people pleasers, we're compensators, we're enablers, and we let people have us do things that they should be doing themselves. Or we're too worried that they'll fail, so we do it anyway. You know, we're control freaks in that respect. We won't let them do anything, we won't let them make mistakes. And that's being dishonest. Because we're not letting them grow. So that's a real sense of dishonesty that isn't discussed in the big book, but clearly is a dishonest thing. Self-seeking, yes? Yes, you write them down. Oh no, you don't put check marks. You write those down. Because that's what you're going to be giving away in step five. Thank you for that question. Self-seeking. I don't know what the translations are in any of your books. It's a tough word. It means selfish. It means, I think the best I can give you is you're looking to how it affects you rather than the other person. So it's how I feel about myself. Let's say with Hitler. How am I self-seeking in relation to Hitler? I feel diminished because I'm not doing everything I can to prevent something bad happening. It's the self-esteem issues. I think that's what self-seeking means. My ex-girlfriend, I used her to make me feel good about myself. I used her because if she liked me, then other people would like me, or other people would respect me. And that's a use of another person. It's self-seeking. It's looking for myself rather than her interests. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And then frightened is fear. Quickly.
Yeah, you could say that self-seeking is when there's action in it.
The question is, for the benefit of the recording, is self-seeking more action and selfish is more thinking? I know that definition, and I've never found it comfortable. I don't understand it, and maybe it makes sense, and I'll think about it again. But if self-seeking is more action, I see it in another way, but you may be right.
Excuse me, just for this word, we also have a different meaning, really, in our language. More has to do with money. Or not only money, but that you do something to get something back.
Self-seeking, you do something to get something back. Okay, so that's action. That may be okay. I'll think about that. I have no answer to that. It doesn't matter. There's no magic to this. Self-seeking will disappear a little bit as we go on anyway. We won't be using it. And then we've got frightened. Any fears you have relating to this. So that is the resentment form. You can see that the fourth column will take a little bit more thought. And often when I work with a sponsee, I will say to them, if you can't figure them out, we can take some of your more difficult ones and go across the page, and I might be able to help to see where you've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Because it's sometimes these are hard for people sometimes to do. Or else I'll say, you know what, we'll pick it up in step five. You know, we'll do in step five. Do what you can, and we'll pick it up in step five, and we'll work through where you've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking. The first step four I ever did, many, many years ago, with a sponsor who didn't know about the fourth column, is I did just the first three columns, and then he spent hours helping me figure out the rest of my role in that. This is a lot faster. What you will discover are patterns. You will discover that if you've written five friends' names down, that once you've worked out the first friend, the other four will be almost exactly the same. Once you've worked your mother out, your father will probably be the same. Once you've worked one child out, the other children will be the same. Once you've worked one husband out, the other husbands will be the same. You will find the patterns in how you approach life. And you'll find very simple patterns. Most of them will be the same. Life isn't going your way. And you'll realize that that's killing you. You have four major character defects. One, you want life to be different from the way it is. Two, you aren't being honest to yourself or to other people. Three, you keep looking for your own gratification and your own feeling good about yourself rather than thinking of other people. You're inconsiderate. And four, you're full of fear. No wonder life isn't going your way. And no wonder you can't remember, oh, I shouldn't eat this. But the big book doesn't stop there. Oh, and by the way, people often say, well, you know, the seven deadly sins or the 27 different character defects that some other people have listed. You know, gossiping is taken as an example in ROA 12 and 12. I've gossiped, and I've written down a particular person I gossiped about. When I came down to selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, selfish, I wanted to look good and him to look bad. Dishonest, I wasn't telling the complete truth about this person. I wasn't talking about the person as a whole. I was making fun of certain parts of that person, the sicker parts, and not explaining that the person I was gossiping about was a sick person who shouldn't be laughed at, but should be felt sorry for. Self-seeking, I wanted to look good. I wanted people to like me for being witty and humorous and making fun of a person that no one else likes. Fear that he would find out about it. Now, I find that that is deeper than gossiping. Listing gossiping as a character defect. It doesn't mean much to me because my reasons for gossiping are the real essence of gossiping. Gossiping is an action I take as a result of the four character defects I have. And I don't find it to be a really helpful character defect to isolate. The same with most of the others, you know, lust and jealousy and pride and all that. I find these to be more powerful and more insightful. But however you do it, it really doesn't matter. I'm just explaining the big book approach. You can see that this form has not taken us a lot of time to fill out. You could do it in a day. I wouldn't suggest it, but you could. Certainly a couple of weeks and it's done. You spend a half an hour a day on it. You know, how many words do you have to use? With all the patterns that you'll see, all the ditto. Do you have the word ditto, 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 meaning the same, the same, the same? You'll find that there are many, many patterns that exhibit themselves. Now what the big book does is take each one of those character defects and show you another light and show you another way of living. And here's what I think is really powerful. There's the fear form. Fear form is really simple to write out. you write down a person, place, or institution that you've already written down and that you have fear related to, which will be almost everything on your list. You write down any other fears you might have. You might not have written down the fear of death or the fear of dying, because that might not be something you think about all the time. Although if I watch Ingmar Bergman movies a lot, it might make me think all Swedes think that way, but I'm just joking. Most of us don't think about dying a lot, but we are afraid of it. So that might be a fear you would write down separately. There are many other fears that you might have. I wrote down, for instance, my daughter went away on a trip to Europe many, many years ago. She was 19. She was with a friend, a girlfriend of hers. They were going to backpack to Europe. And they were both really attractive young women. And my fears, when I started to write them down, were, I'm afraid that, their tent will leak, or that they won't find a hostel to stay in. And then they became, I'm afraid that they will be robbed. And then it became, I'm afraid that they will be assaulted. And then I'm afraid that they will be sexually assaulted. Then I'm afraid that not only will they be sexually assaulted, they will be kidnapped and put into white slavery. And here I am on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, unable to do anything. And you watch your fears build up. So I wrote down my daughter under a fear, even though I might not have had a resentment at that time in relation to her. She was 19. She had changed by the time she was 16. So there are fears that you can have that aren't related. That's the first column, and you write all those fears down. The second column, point form, why do you have those fears? And, very often you'll be copying almost what you had already written down about those people under resentments, plus you may have others. And what I discovered about that is my fears ranged from reasonable concerns to completely overgrown hysteria. And writing it down enabled me to see the transition from, sometimes I had very reasonable concerns. I'm worried about climate change. I don't know if anyone here is. I have a feeling that many people are. And I'm really worried about it and what it's going to do to our climate, what it's going to do to my children, my grandchildren and my grandchild and how further grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. And I'm worried about the world that we're going to live in. And that's not an unreasonable concern, to be concerned about things like that, or concerned about wars, concerned about, nuclear weapons, things of that sort. There may be a part of town, I don't know if there is any part of Copenhagen that you're afraid to be in. Yes, right here. Oh, this area, okay. All right. So you may write down this area or some area similar to this in your own town. And it might not be unreasonable to think, I run certain risks here that I don't run in other parts of Copenhagen or other parts of my city. So you might write these fears down. So the second column is why you have those fears. And you will find, if you're like me, you'll find that your fears range from being reasonable to being completely ridiculous. But you have them, so write them down. And then the big book gives you the form gives you two simple questions. One is, in having this fear, are you relying on infinite God or on your finite self? I think I'm relying on my finite self, because if I were relying on infinite God, I wouldn't be afraid. So you check the relying on finite self. And then the question is, did it help you to rely on your finite self? And the answer, no, I don't think it helped, because if I relied on my finite self, and I didn't have fear, I wouldn't have fear. So you have fear, it didn't help. Do you see that on the form, those things?
What is finite self?
Finite self is just me. I'm finite. I'm not infinite. I'm finite. I'm here for a certain period of time in this space and time. God is everywhere. That's the idea. For all time. And then the question becomes, then you say a prayer. And it's a very important and interesting prayer. God, please remove this particular fear. Name the fear. Please remove my fear of flying. Please remove my fear of death. Oh, by the way, just to say, when it comes to death, why am I afraid of death? What I discovered was fascinating. I'm afraid of missing out. I'm afraid of causing injury or sadness to my loved ones. I'm afraid of the passage of death, the transition, the pain that death may bring before I die. Well, those are three very different fears. You know, I may never reach my potential. Maybe another one. So it's really writing them out. I mean, when you write out your fears and why you have them, it's already a liberating experience. So many of them are liberating. I had a fear, and I won't bore you with it, but I had a fear that I would never write out because I was afraid of writing it out. Because once someone knew that fear, or if that piece of paper got in the hands of anyone, I don't know if any of you read George Orwell's 1984, but you don't speak your fear because that fear will meet you in room 102 or whatever it was. So these are the things that you would write down. Then the prayer comes. God, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. Not do, but be. And when you write that, say that prayer, the next column is, what would God have you be? And I would phrase it, a person who. God would have me be a person who. And then whatever fits in there. It's not always obvious what you would write down, but it usually comes down to something, a person who looks for the best. I wrote down with respect to my daughter in Europe, a father who makes my daughter aware that he is there if he's needed, and who allows her to grow. What else can I be in relation to that fear? She's here, I'm there. There's nothing else. This part of town that I'm afraid to be in. I'm sorry you told me I should be afraid to be in here. I walked around, you know. What would God have me be in relation to my fear of this place? A person who does not take unnecessary risks. I mean, that's not an unreasonable thing that God would have me be. I'm afraid of being divorced. A person who gives love and lives a life according to love, justice, and beauty, and truth. I'm afraid of climate change. A person who does what he can do and accepts the limitations of what he can do. You know, it's the serenity prayer all over again. And what happens is that your legitimate concerns, because many of your fears will be legitimate and reasonable concerns, change from paralysis, paralyzing fear, into strategies for life. Does that make sense? And thus, you outgrow fear. The Big Book promises that you immediately outgrow fear. Of course you outgrow it. You become mature in relation to it. It's not if you're saying, I'm afraid, I won't go there, I won't do anything. It's, I will not go there because it is unreasonable for me to go there unless I need to be there, like right now. You know, and that's a completely different approach to life. It's actually mature. It's grown up. We're not kids anymore. We're not full of fear. We're full of reasonable senses of what people we should be. And I can tell you this works. Guaranteed it works. It's amazing how you can outgrow your fears. Marlene, can I have 5 minutes?
Six for the sex.
I can have six, yeah, six for sex, right. So that's the fear form. The sex conduct form is fascinating because you'll see that it asks this question. You write down the names of people you've hurt. Now, first of all, sex conduct in 1939 was not what sex means today. Sex means today the physical acts of sex. Generally speaking, that's what it means, at least in English. I don't know what it would mean in your languages. But sex means today something different from what it meant in 1939 in the United States. Sex in 1939 included, of course, all the physical sexual stuff, but it also dealt with relationships in which there was some attraction, some physical attraction. So it could be deal with, I mean, I have written down people I hurt, people I flirted with. If the word, Marlene, I'm taking an extra 5 minutes because I'm just trying to finish this thought. Will you let me do that? Thank you. Okay. And then we'll leave, right on the mark. We'll march and follow.
My fingers up.
Okay. So sex conduct is any relationship in which there is some attraction and an imbalance, because you're only looking at where you've hurt someone. I'll give you a simple, obviously I put my wife down at a certain point. I put down a few ex-girlfriends. I didn't put them all down. I didn't have that many, but I didn't put all of them down. With some of them I had good relationships. With some of them, I did some things that I thought were hurtful, so I put them down. I put down a friend of ours. We have a couple we spend a lot of time with, And I used to flirt outrageously with the wife. In front of my wife and her husband, my close friend. And the flirting would never go anywhere. Do you know what the word flirt means? Is that, yeah. Yeah, it's the same. It never went anywhere because we both loved our own spouses. I'd never cheat on my wife. I never would want to. But there was something going on there, so I put her down. I don't know if any of you remember or have seen Mary Tyler Moore, but she's an actress who is well-known, and a comedic actress. But there are women around who have very high cheekbones and very thin and have a slight overbite and hard to explain. But for some reason, people who look like her made me speechless for a certain time. I could not have relationships with them. I pardon me, but that was the truth. And there was actually the mother of a girl who was on the same team as my daughter was. And while I would converse with all the other parents during practices, I would never be able to talk to her. I put her down, even though I had no relationship with her. It was the fact I didn't have a relationship with her that caused me to put her down. So you just put the names of those people down. The next column is fascinating. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? If you look at self-seeking as thinking of yourself, inconsiderate is not thinking of others. So you've got selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate. It's selfish, dishonest, self-seeking. Where have I been those things? So we're now looking at relationships that are sometimes difficult because the bodies are talking as well as the mind. They're not friend relationships. There's also body stuff going on. There's attraction. There's hormones. There's whatever goes on in our bodies that are talking as well. And I'm looking at, and so they're difficult relationships. They're in many ways more difficult than just friends are because there's the body is leading us in different directions. So we're analyzing those relationships and we're seeing where we've been selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking or inconsiderate. And we write those things down. Often we'll have copied, depending on who was on our list, we'll have copied down the things that we had in the original resentment list. And then the big book says, where did we arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? And then comes, and we put in a check mark if we did or we didn't. We may or may not have. And then we write out the most important thing. Where did I go wrong? What should I have done instead? And now we're beginning to see a life free of selfishness, dishonesty, and self-seeking. A life in which we're unselfish, in which we're honest, and in which we're considerate and thinking of other people. And we see in relation to all these relationships, these difficult relationships, how we could have lived our lives differently. We're learning from our mistakes. Generally speaking, what we should have done instead, we should always have been more honest. And generally, we should either have invested more in the other person's welfare or got out of the relationship sooner. Generally, those are the mistakes that we often make. And you begin to see such a simple pattern. Either you invest yourself in a relationship with people and be honest with them, or else be honest with them and leave the relationship. And this is a life that's unselfish. You're unselfish and honest and considerate. You know, I stayed in relationships in which I hurt people by staying in the relationship. I stayed in relationships in which I hurt people by not leaving the relationship. That's the same thing. And when my wife was on the list, I realized that whatever was bothering me about her was not what I should deal with. What I should deal with is giving her more love, thinking more of her needs rather than mine. And once I realized that, my whole life changed because I realized what it was like to live unselfishly, honestly, and considerately. I might have had to speak to her, and at times I did, honestly from the heart about things that I wanted to talk about. But that's separate from the other things about how much I had to live in terms of her life and helping her. So, just to end this long 5 minutes, you can see how you work from your resentments. You isolate your character defects with selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. You then deal with those character defects in the fear and sex conduct forms and see how you can live a life as a mature person free of fear and as a mature person who is honest and unselfish and considerate of others. Your world is opening, not closing. You don't feel bad about yourself. You see how these defects of character have harmed you in your own life. And now the big book says, if we've been thorough about our personal limit, this is page 85, paragraph 5 in the Danish version. If we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. We've listed and analyzed our resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. See, it's only resentments they're talking about, because the other two are the defects of character that we're dealing with. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. We look on them as sick people. We've listed the people we've hurt by our conduct, are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you have made a good beginning. Grosser. Now, gross today means yuck. Ugh. That's not what it means. Grosser means the big ones. Get it done. Don't stop at this step. Get it done. What I can promise you is that in step 5, you'll know whether you've done enough. But if you're spending more than 6 weeks doing this, you're putting it off. Don't go for perfectionism. Just get rid of what you've done in step 5. That being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Tomorrow, I'm going to do 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. I'm going to do 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 quickly, and I will show you how the big book deals with them quickly. And then I'll go into more detail, a bit on step 10, a bit more on step 11, and a lot on step 12. Thank you.